Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 22, and today I'm joined by a group of undergraduate students from my Philosophy 200 class in fall 2009, and I'm really excited to have them all here. So this is the biggest group that we've had on The Digital Dialogue, I'm really excited that you all came of your own accord to come and talk a little bit about what we've been talking about this semester. So maybe we could go around and just have you each introduce yourself, who you are, and your year, maybe a word or two about what you're working on for your paper this semester, and also your major would be good. So Drew, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Drew Bullard. I'm a junior, and I'm majoring in biology with a minor in philosophy. So far for the paper that I'm working on, I'm focusing around the symposium, and especially the speech Socrates gives about what he learned from Diotima in his time there, and the nature of Eros based on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hi, I'm Jordan Sanford. I'm a philosophy major with a minor in women's studies. I'm a junior right now, and my paper is about the role of nature in dialogue. Mm-hmm.
I'm Cody Shinsky. My major is political science with a minor in history. I'm a junior. Mm-hmm. And my paper is I'm writing a defense of Gorgias' definition of rhetoric as a communal activity benefiting everyone in the community and also as being value neutral.
Great. All right.
I'm Anthony Zappoli. I'm a philosophy major. I'm a senior. My paper is about the psychoanalytic aspects of the Phaedrus speech regarding the charioteer and the two horses.
Mm-hmm. I'm Tony Arnold. I'm a senior philosophy major with an English minor, and I'm writing a paper on how Socrates exemplifies the characteristics of the foreigner.
Mm-hmm. I'm Pam Dorian. I'm a sophomore. I'm a triple major in poli-sci, communication arts and sciences and philosophy, with a minor in classics and Mediterranean studies. And right, just because. And my paper is on the nature of competition and dialogue and Socratic method.
Excellent.
My name is Joni Noggle. I'm a philosophy and psychology major. I'm a sophomore, and I'm specifically writing about the charioteer allegory of the soul, and specifically about the unruly horse and the driving force towards divinity.
Great. Wow. Thank you all. This is I'm excited already to read these papers. But it's interesting also to see. It's interesting to see how over the course of the semester I've seen your different interests grow and each one of you, much like the characters in the symposium itself, who speaks in his own voice. About love, it's interesting to see that each of your papers has the mark of your interest, and it's been wonderful to see that develop over the course of the semester. One of the themes that I've felt or heard in what you were all talking about is the theme, obviously, of Eros and love. And so I would like to maybe start by talking about the relationship between Eros and the good, which we've really been talking about all semester in some ways. So one of the points that I've been pressing is Socrates is aware of the power of Eros as a way of orienting human beings toward the question of the good. And so maybe we could talk a little bit about that. Does anybody have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, John. Yeah, I mean, that kind of directly ties to a lot of what my paper centers on. I mean, in the charioteer allegory, the driving force that sort of allows the soul movement towards the good is Eros. It's sort of
right.
Like that driving force behind any movement that, you know, would allow a soul to achieve like a philosophical good life. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot of what I'm talking about. I think that Eros is, at its very basic level, just a force, but one has to orient it towards the right direction and orient it towards the good. And so, you know, depending on the individual, depending on the circumstance, you may be oriented in different ways, but either way, I think Eros is what sort of allows the soul movement towards a higher state of being.
And that's really what, in some ways, is at stake in this allegory of the charioteer. Tony, you were going to say something?
It's really interesting, though. I mean, if Eros drives us toward the good. I mean, it's really interesting how that relates to philosophy, because ostensibly that's what Socrates is practicing. And there's a different kind of love implicit in philosophy. It's philia.
Right.
And more of a brotherly love. And it's almost to what degree is the erotic desire active in this search for the good? And almost, does that even connote like sort of an appetite, like the chariot allegory might, you know, this erotic desire?
There is a really nice article by a man named Drew Hyland, who is a member of the Ancient Philosophy Society that I'm a part of. He teaches at Trinity College, and he's written an article about that really traces the different meaning between three terms in the symposium. Thumos, which is more translated as kind of desire, but it has more of the emotional connotations, less of the rational component. Eros, which is also perhaps has a rational dimension, especially given the allegory of the charioteer. There might be, what is this horse that does listen to reason? What does that do? And then philia, which may be what Socrates is trying to bring those desirous components of our psyche under the control of philia, which has the erotic in it, but it also might have the component of the rational. So I don't think we want to dichotomize too much the rational from the irrational components. One of the things we've been talking about this semester in the Phaedrus is the different kinds of madness, right?
And it's,
go ahead, Tony.
Sorry, it's interesting to tie those together too, because I just recently read an article about how Socrates, the way he speaks of philosophy he practices, is kind of a marriage of sobriety and passion. And so that kind of just really ties in.
And one of the things we need to always be careful of in philosophy is this hyper praise of reason, and forgetting of the desirous, the irrational, that which is a part of human existence. Anthony, you were going to say something.
One thing I find really interesting is how the idea of Eros and its connection to being a driving force behind life evolves throughout the history of philosophy. Because it seems to get picked up time and again by Platonics and, I guess, anti-Platonics, for lack of a better word.
Right.
Like, it gets picked up with the Conatus and Spinoza. Nietzsche picks it up with the will to power. And, of course, in psychoanalysis, it gets picked up very strongly with the idea of the libido being the psychological force behind ideas and actions. And I think it says a lot about how, considering that the Platonic dialogues are some of the earliest recorded philosophies that we have, that this idea has stuck so strongly in philosophy. I think it gives it a lot of credentials, especially with this notion that I think it's in either the Gorgias or the Protagoras, I'm not 100% sure which it is, where Socrates talks about how you can't desire to do wrong. And that idea, that simple little idea, really gets carried over into Descartes, gets carried over into Spinoza.
Well, definitely, it has a long tradition in philosophy, but there is also a tendency in philosophy to minimize the messiness of the erotic and subvert it to reason, right? Because maybe the charioteer analogy is in part contributes to that, right? Because the charioteer is nous,
I was going to say there's sort of that danger where you try to put that into this box, this category, and sort of a lot that I do with my paper is talking about how while that driving force may seem like this just unruly passion, it's also drive, it's also motivation, it's also all these some of them subtle sort of forces at work that sort of initiate movement.
Well, this actually brings me to Cody. I know you're writing on the Gorgias and on Gorgias's view of rhetoric. I mean, it actually makes me think exactly of this. Remember the point in the Gorgias where Socrates introduces the idea of I think it's Socrates who introduces it. The idea of Gorgias and his brother, who's a doctor. I guess Gorgias introduces it. Say the power of rhetoric is, well, the doctor can know all kinds of important things, but if you can't get the person to take the medicine, that's going to be a problem. So there's a dimension of Gorgias's understanding of his own practice of rhetoric that has this motivational force behind it, right? So I wonder, is that part of what you're going to be talking about, you think, in your paper?
A little bit. I mean, I do touch upon it inside the paper, and I do stress in it that the way that Gorgias sees rhetoric inside the paper, in reference to that doctor metaphor, is that it's meant for a good. He convinced that guy to take the medicine, that the doctor was unable to do, and so he sees it as a good. Now, unlike Paulus and Callicles, who sees it as kind of increasing their own kind of personal.
So
powers.
you read Gorgias's rhetoric as actually oriented toward the good and toward the just, right? And make a distinction between what Gorgias is doing and what his students might be doing.
Yeah.
Because, right? we just had this discussion yesterday on Digital Dialogue, episode 21, which just went up. So give a listen to it, because I have a couple graduate students on there who are really working on exactly this area.
Okay.
And the argument that Nicholas Parra is trying to make in his paper is to suggest that actually, a friendship between Gorgias and Socrates emerges in the Gorgias, and one that embodies a possible friendship between rhetoric and philosophy. And so I think it might fit well with, especially if you play off the idea of what's happening in that beginning scene in the Gorgias, where you have the teachers and the students together.
Yeah.
First, Chaerephon and Paulus try to do this thing, and they're both sort of bad at it. You know, they're like bad images of their teachers. So that whole issue of the teacher-student relationship is at stake there. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was going to ask you, Jordan, about this nature and dialogue point. That's what you're writing on, right?
Yeah. I'm doing it on the Phaedrus, focusing on the myth of the cicadas, and there's a couple different takes on what happens with that. There's some talk about what it means to be in the foreground and what it means to be in the background of what a dialogue is, like underlying tendencies of what you're trying to get at versus what is actually being said, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back to some of our conversations about language. And there's also, and I mean, I haven't fully fleshed out the ideas yet. I'm still trying to get it in my own words, so to speak. But the way that Socrates kind of handles Phaedrus, and we talked about this, like, what does he actually learn anything? Does he actually come out of it with something? Like, is what he's learning just the foreground stuff, or is he getting the background of what's happening?
Right. So how does that play out, the sort of foreground, background? Does that map onto what's explicitly said in the dialogue versus what is shown by the dialogue? Right? Is that what's partly?
I think a little
at stake?
Of both, actually. Mm-hmm. What happens is in the Phaedrus, they focus a lot on what their surroundings are. I mean, in very few other dialogues, we actually have any idea of what's kind of going on beside them. But in the Phaedrus, we've talked about this in class. They're walking beside a river. Like the clothes are kind of explained.
Right.
They go in the forest, and it's everything's really vivid. But as they begin talking, it is. But as they begin talking, that kind of fades into the background. But it's still always there. Mm-hmm. And when Socrates goes to, or when they both switch from the discussion of love to the discussion of rhetoric, Socrates brings back up the background as a kind of signifier, trying to possibly remind Phaedrus of, like, the role that, you know, I'm not quite sure the word really, but
so maybe the role of see if you buy this. I don't know, because I'm just trying to think along with you on this regard. The way in which the background is always operating.
Right. It's always there, even if we're not conscious of
it. So I wonder if that can be, if we could think about that in relationship to the transition you're talking about. And we'd have to look at the text and see how it played out, and you can do that in your paper if you want. But if, in fact, the issue of rhetoric emerges or is allowed to reemerge when the background is foregrounded, I wonder what that might mean about rhetoric.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah.
Another kind of focus of the paper is the potential to have a dialogue with nature. I think it's really apparent that our environment matters. in the blog, this is important because, like, style is sort of like our nature. The way someone expresses themselves means a whole lot for, you know, what they're saying.
Right.
And I think that nature kind of does the same thing, and I think that the Phaedrus says this. I need to fill out the argument.
Right.
But
right.
I think that we can all, like, if we had a bad day, we can go out, take a walk. If it's a nice day, like, we'll feel calmed. You know, mm-hmm. I think that really is a definite sort of dialogue.
So there's a therapeutic dimension of nature.
Right.
I think you probably could flesh out the dialogical relationship that humans have with nature in a really powerful way, and it might be actually related. I know, Anthony, you were mentioning about the Eros also having a biological dimension, mm-hmm. and actually Socrates as Diotima emphasized this in at least at the beginning of her discussion of the ladder of love. It's Eros is in fact something shared, I think, by all of nature to some degree, mm-hmm. right? And it drives, you know, the bees to the flowers and other kinds and human beings to one another, right? So there's a way in which a really robust naturalistic understanding of that is potentially powerful, and to think about that as a way of animating what it might mean. Yeah, Anthony, you were going to say something.
I think something that's really interesting about the Phaedrus, compared with some of the other stories that we read, is throughout them, with Socrates is always talking to someone. He's usually talking one-on-one with them.
Right.
Sometimes they have other people interject, but it's usually a one-on-one conversation, but those other people are always in the background.
Yeah.
But in the Phaedrus is truly a one-on-one encounter.
Right.
There's really no other individuals around. So it's something that occurred to me.
We got the cicadas, right? We got to deal with
the cicadas. Other than the cicadas.
And the plane tree, the platanos tree, right?
And the tree, and I guess the gods to a certain degree.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a whole lot of things around.
But they're
right. not humans.
Yeah, not
And then
humans.
Socrates makes that point a little bit about, well, you know, that he hangs around the city because that's what he wants to hear other people. So this is actually bringing out this question of, well, what can one learn from nature? But go ahead.
But something that's really interesting is this notion on this one-on-one conversation.
Yeah.
Because throughout, like I mentioned with all the other dialogues, it's always a one-on-one conversation with him and someone else for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you have occasional interjections, but usually he either brushes them aside or deals with them quickly and then gets back onto the conversation.
Right.
But this real one-on-one, and to a certain degree, this erotic aspect in the Phaedrus.
Yeah, certain degree, yeah. Pretty
I think
heavily erotic. I don't
just a tad bit.
No need to mince words on that one. Yeah,
yeah.
There definitely is an erotic dimension to it.
But I think that that there's a possibility of investigating this connection between the erotic nature in the Phaedrus with this one-on-one conversation compared with the erotic feature in the other dialogues with these one-on-one conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Because with all of them, especially with this idea of Eros being a driving force, there's always going to be an erotic undertone to what's going on. And with Phaedrus, it comes to the surface. It's no longer simply an undertone. It's really out there.
Definitely. Joining in.
Yeah. Just while you were talking, I mean, it's almost set up like the Phaedrus is like a control, and where all the other variables are like taken out of the equation. All, you know, things that are distractions are taken out, and everything is in its very essence just this one-on-one dialogue. And so you can really see the direct connections easier that way because there aren't other variables to take into account.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But to what degree might Phaedrus be a spectator? Because he carries a manuscript with him.
Right.
And Socrates is hesitant about leaving the city, and he said that the trees don't have much to teach him. Now the people do, and I know that he gets more comfortable as he moves on.
Well,
but
just one point in addition to that, he says that, but then doesn't Phaedrus look to Socrates for information about the road to here and when the gods and where the altar of one of the gods is. So Socrates shows himself to be a little bit more familiar with the woods and in nature than he lets on at first. But your point is well taken. He says, I don't come here.
And when he sees the manuscript, he seems to lose all interest in hearing Phaedrus. And in Phaedrus as Phaedrus,
right.
and he's interested in hearing the speech itself,
right.
And he says, and I mean, he blatantly says that Lysias is with us,
right,
in some form,
right.
And it's almost as if there's now a more of a triad than anything.
Right. And so, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a conversation going on with Lysias.
Yes, but two questions. One is, does Socrates ever lose his focus on Phaedrus and turning Phaedrus? I definitely think that his concern is with the Phaedrus's soul and whether it can be turned to recognize that the speech he's trying to memorize is not a good speech. And also the process of memorization, that kind of learning, where you memorize and regurgitate, is not what is ultimately going to be, that's not going to be nourishing to your soul, to put it that way.
But it's almost like the Gorgias, where Socrates kind of interpolates Callicles, and Gorgias kind of becomes secondary to the issue. I mean, they're talking about Gorgias, yeah. but he says, you know, I'm interested in convincing you, Callicles, not everybody else around here, and the background comes
right.
up. And it's almost as if that's what happens, as if Lysias becomes a secondary audience, if you will.
You mean Phaedrus? If Phaedrus becomes a secondary audience.
Well, actually, even turning toward, if Phaedrus is the one to be turned,
uh-huh.
is there still this audience in the background?
Oh, I see.
Still part of the city there, part of the agora.
Yeah, they bring it with them, is what you're saying,
yeah.
in some ways, right? Yeah. No, I think that's true. I wonder what we would make of that whole issue with regard to Phaedrus having the written speech of Lysias, mm-hmm. And wanting to memorize it and wanting to repeat it.
Yeah.
How does that relate to what Socrates says later in the dialogue about the written word and how the written word is actually going to problematize memorizing? It's not going to be something that is really conducive to education. Drew, you want to say something?
Yeah, actually, like going on that more, like dealing with the myth about like the written word coming along and how in some way it ends up destroying like a part of us, a certain ability of us. Like we were discussing in class the one day, when you have to go through and be taught everything like individually, like somebody passes their knowledge on to you.
Right.
Stays with you much more because that's your knowledge base. It's with you wherever you go.
Mm-hmm.
But when we start writing things down, like one example is like, you know, with the advent of cell phones, you know, people don't have to memorize a number. It's okay, you know, send me your number, I'll store it, and you know, and it's done.
Right.
To some degree, like you could argue that it does make us weaker in one capability because we're not exercising our memories as
right.
much as we could be.
Right.
So memorizing, even though like memorizing a speech to some extent would be storing that knowledge within you, it's also taking away your necessary view on it. If you're just reciting someone else, we could go listen to them and
right.
that would be it. But
right.
It should be more.
But I mean, there's a way in which, and this is something that interests me pedagogically speaking, and I'd actually be interested to hear what you guys have to say about this, because one of my pedagogical goals always has been, can I encourage students and empower students to take an active role in their own education? And there's a way in which Phaedrus, at the beginning, is taking an active role, but he's memorizing the words of another. Okay, so I think Socrates is drawn to Phaedrus in some respect because he's a lover of speeches. He's a lover of logoi.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he calls him. And that's the connection that Socrates and Phaedrus seem to have. The issue of writing versus the oral tradition is one that's, I think, really important here, because yes, what is in the oral tradition, you have to memorize, and that's a skill, that's a taking over of information and of some knowledge,
mm-hmm.
taking into yourself the things said by the poets. But is it a taking into yourself in a way that is just simply a taking over what's been handed down? Is it really an active engagement with the information?
I think that's like dependent on the individual, because I think sometimes for some things it is sort of foundational and necessary to do that, just, you know, direct internalization, memorization.
Right.
I think it depends on the individual if they're going to actually take that and actively sort of analyze it themselves. But I think sometimes it is, you do need that memorization to just get the information to be able to actually work with it.
Right.
And that's sometimes necessary.
Yeah, I would definitely, for sure. Pam, you were going to say something.
Yeah, my immediate thought, I guess, is kind of like yes and no.
Uh-huh.
Like basically what you were saying, it depends on the individual. I was thinking about actors, they just have to memorize a bunch of words, but they at the same time they have to like bring out, you know, the character, then like give the words some give the words a face, I guess. So I mean, I guess you can, there's like a some sense of activity and memorization, but I think it depends on the individual.
Well, this is actually the issue that's at stake in the Ion, in Plato's Ion. Socrates gets his hands around this this poet, this Ion, who is a rhapsode, and that means he performs these poems, these Homeric poems and things, and he's great at it. He's great at the performance, but when Socrates presses him on the content, like, you know, is this just a divine inspiration that's doing this, or do you actually understand what you're even saying, right? And, you know, Ion is, you know, loves to be in front of people on a stage and loves to be good at what he does, so he's not really that smart about, you know, the meanings of these stories. And so that's exactly the issue that he highlights there. Drew, you want to say something?
Yeah, actually, I mean, just to keep going on that, like, that's the fundamental difference, I guess, between knowing and understanding something. Like, you know, I'm not saying that written language is bad. I'm not in any way. I mean, it's great to be able to share knowledge and write it down. Otherwise, we wouldn't have these books. So,
Well, that's an important point.
Yeah.
Yeah, we wouldn't be talking about if Plato hadn't decided to ignore his teacher, right? But and who didn't write and actually write something down.
Right, but even though he's writing it down, one good thing that he does, like we've definitely talked about in class multiple times, is that he keeps it in a dialogue form. Mm-hmm. It's not just like, okay, here's what I think.
Right.
Now you think that.
Right.
It really like puts you into the scenario of what they're doing and allows you to comprehend more what the message is through experiencing the dialogue itself.
Right. Let's go. Right. You want to say something?
Kind of going off that, I really have come to enjoy the dialogue format. The not, like you said, this is what I think, take it or leave it. It encourages people to think, to, you know, actively, you know, go and try to figure out what it's saying and then apply it. You know, a lot of the times, if people see something very specifically, they can just, it'd be very easy to fall into just using it for one instance.
Right.
But with this, you can refer anything back to this, you know?
I mean, how do you see can you think of specific examples in which the text makes you do that? You know, makes you really, makes you wonder, makes you take a more active role, and how does it do it?
Well, the symposium, I think, that we're going over right now is a perfect example. It's a story twice told secondhand, is the quote.
Yeah, and like, Strauss from Strauss.
Who knows what that really makes out of it? And all the time he brings back, like, this isn't, you know, the people speaking aren't my words.
Right.
You know, Socrates isn't voiced for Plato, that's come back all the time.
Right.
And neither is Diotima, despite, you know, like, their interjection there.
Right.
And it's important to kind of, like I said, try to find the background of what's going on, the underlying message that can be interpreted.
Yeah, Anthony.
I feel to a very large degree that having the written word and really writing books, even like with this dialogue, helps preserve cultural history and cultural heritage a lot more than the oral tradition does.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like with the oral tradition, what you get more often than not is the format and the structure and the problem. The structure and the problem of the cultures the day that it's being told,
right?
And not so much the problems that may have been then, and not so much the actual history, but possibly a spun history to provide, you know, whether it's a moral lesson to the children, or provide an idea for how to handle a situation going on today, as opposed to with this with a written tradition. It's easier to go back and understand and look at the culture in itself. Now, you're always going to have an issue with your current culture and your current mindset spilling over into that.
Right.
And I'm not 100% sure that you can ever get the pure form of...
Well, I'm 100% sure that you can't get the pure form.
Yeah, you can't get the pure form.
But the idea is to try, right? That's part of being as someone who is interested in these things. Try to imagine your way into life in that time, trying to imagine your way out of the prejudices that you bring to it. But of course, we are who we are. We can't really escape. We can't escape reading through the lens of where we're situated. So that is no question about that. But I actually wonder about what is lost with the writing. That is to say, the oral tradition gives us a certain dynamism. And this is the thing that Socrates is worried about, I think, in the Phaedrus. Well, when you start writing, and of course, let me just say, it's something that I'm very worried about and wonder about in terms of the digital media that we've been using in class. What is gained and what is lost? What are the possibilities that open with this? But what are the real problems that sort of come with it? And I think something similar is at stake. When we move from an oral tradition to a literate tradition, something's gained, something's lost. And I think something similar is at stake here, and I'd be interested to hear what you guys feel about that. Tony?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, I mean, obviously you're implying how, oral traditions pass down and ends up changing, you know, based on the speaker and everything. And I think writing, I mean, I think one of the problems might, well, I guess be viewed as a problem is that the text is immutable in some way, it doesn't change. But I think there's something also to be said about commentary, too.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, the Hebraic tradition, the Jewish tradition, that was all oral originally, but then, there's commentary upon commentary, there's commentary on commentary.
Right.
You know, there's a written conversation that goes on, and it's all visible.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I think it's almost like having your cake and eating it, too.
Yeah.
But except the law itself doesn't change in that case. Then then it does become... Well, it's interesting then to consider whether or not that might enable a sort of fundamentalism, I guess, actually, too, because it fixes things,
and it also potentially can set up the keepers of the truth model, right? And so that's what I see as really potentially powerful about the digital media that we've been using in class, is that it can, at least in theory, open things up so that other voices that aren't usually heard in this context are in fact there. So, and that would then could potentially challenge this sort of orthodoxy that might emerge. It does point to a really important thing that I think we need to think about in terms of the activity of philosophy. What are we doing when we do philosophy? Well, in one sense, what we're doing is we are just engaging in an ongoing dialogue with our predecessors, with the original text, and with commentaries on those texts, with the new original texts that emerge out of that. And that's what we are doing, and we're thinking with and against those things as we pass this along to another generation. So go ahead, Joni.
Yeah, I mean, that's, whenever we're talking about the subject, it's sort of, I'm always amazed at sort of like the power of the written word. And I always think of the Constitution.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's so foundational to how we run this country and everything. And you'd think something that's been written, it's very explicit, has been around, and it's very clear about some things, and yet still to this day we're constantly debating what it in fact means, which is sort of what I take as sort of the greatest power of the written word. While it is there and it's explicit, it has to stand on its own, and it allows for such a varied and wide array of interpretations that sort of allows so many more avenues, since it's just this static text.
Yeah, building on what you just said, as you know, I'm taking my rhetorical theory class, and just a little plug there, shout out John Stan. Anyway,
he was on the Digital Dialogue, a guest on.
Yeah.
What episode was that? I've done too many. I used to have them all in my head. Like Chris Johnstone teaching rhetorical theory. Right?
No, but when we learned the origins of studying rhetoric and rhetorical criticism, actually that was one of the factors that we had to memorize, basically, is the invention of the written word made it easier, I guess, for people to like see the speech and criticize it. So that's the, I guess, one of the more powerful things about writing things down, is it gives you the ability to just look at it and, you know, write all over it and criticize it.
Well, so that's actually an interesting point that brings me to something I want to hear your thoughts on, which is, I mean, one of the main critiques of the digital media that we've been using together, I mean, really, we've really used this to create a community, and it's been a pretty powerful one that's hopefully will outlive this class, but one that is certainly, even if it doesn't, it has been a living community that's been really important, I know, to a number of you in the room, and also certainly to me. And I wonder, though, one of the criticisms of this is that it's too fast. It's too much. It doesn't slow things. And so if writing, as you're suggesting, slowed things down enough so that we could really sit there and analyze and look at the parts of it, and that opened up possibility for interpretation and critique and subtlety, does the speed of the blog format, for example, cause a real problem? Is it too fast?
It's kind of the same as a library. Like, just because you go into a library, you don't have to read all the books there, you mm-hmm. know? I mean, the blog is fast. I mean, we've had a page, like the whole front page of your blog, change in a day's time.
Right.
But despite that, you don't have to read every blog, you know? Sometimes, right. Like, I'll skim titles. If I see something really interesting, mm-hmm. I'll pay attention to it. If mm-hmm. I don't, you know, I'll move to the next thing. Mm-hmm. If for someone that has to keep up with everything, like you, mm-hmm. it's probably a little more difficult. But for, you know, the casual reader, right. or even the class, right. you know, student, I don't think it's overwhelming, but it's definitely something that you have to kind of get out of the mindset of, but I have to know everything.
But can it casual reading, okay, but can it cultivate, you know, rigorous, slow reading, attention to detail? One of the things that I really appreciated about a lot of the posts is that they, that you've taken specific lines from the text, and then you've written around that, and then a conversation has come up about that. Now, it may not be the whole class that joins in on that particular issue, and it may be that, as you can hear from the diversity of interest that you have in your papers, that a certain group of students congregate on a specific issue. But I do worry about it being so fast and so much. And I think that's the thing I'm struggling with as trying to keep up with it, is that I have it delivered to me on all sorts of different devices, on my computer, my phone, and all this stuff. And I'm, in the line at the grocery store seeing who's posted what and all that, right? So I'm constantly reading all the time what's happening on the blog. But it's a lot to keep up with. Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
Yes, just personal experience. I know I've had probably more times than I'd like where I find out that there was this whole elaborate conversation that I didn't get to join in with. Yeah. And I don't know how I missed it. I mean, I honestly don't.
Right.
And it's just because sometimes there are so many, and I think case in point is today,
yeah.
there are just so many posts.
This is the end of the evaluation yeah. period, so people are yeah. posting yeah. a little bit yeah. more. All of a sudden, you can see the activity curve go up.
So many posts and so many comments, and then I somehow, like, I just dig into one.
Yeah.
Like, Anthony's post on language, I mean, I don't know how I ended up bypassing that, or...
Right.
But and then sometimes by the time I get there are like 30 comments or something,
right.
and then it can get a bit unwieldy. I mean, it's worthwhile, and I'd like to hear everybody, hear what everybody right. has to say. But sometimes it's a lot, because you got to go down and make sure that you're not going over somebody else's.
Right,
point.
You want to yeah. be a part of the That's discussion. True. Yeah, are you joining in?
Well, I think it's just like the scope. Like I know, especially we were able to. See that when we had another class join us,
right.
it just sort of like had this little yeah. explosion, just exactly. because yeah. it's just like an exponential.
That was great, but it was
yeah.
hard. It was.
Yeah. Yeah. I think. If there were just just us in a room and we were all just this
yeah.
number of people
right.
on a blog, I don't think it would be quite right. as.
Yeah, I mean, I struggle with that because on the one hand, I mean, the content that's being generated on there, a lot of it is really good, and. And, you know, students are taking an active role. You guys are jumping on there. You're doing it. And I hope that the way it was set up with the rubric that sort of just didn't give you assignments but asked you to post as you were moved by the material and as you developed your own interest in the area that you were interested in. I was hoping that would empower you to find a voice and it's interesting that each of you in certain ways you we know sort of the issues that each of us have gravitated to, and that's great. You learn more about the person. But I do worry about the scope of it. On the other hand, you would have never written nearly as much as you in fact wrote. I normally would ask for maybe three page papers or something in a class like this, and then a final project. You guys are all doing a final project, a traditional research project. But if you took the writing that you've all, that each of you has done, and looked at, I mean, you've written a lot of stuff, mm-hmm. and the course has gone in directions I couldn't have anticipated. So as a faculty member, I'm looking at this as, look at the possibilities here, but also what happened, what does it mean when we lose, you lose as a faculty member some control. That is mm-hmm. to say, I'm not determining what, you know, issues are vital here. Mm-hmm. We are together, Anthony.
I felt as though the blog throughout the semester was first and foremost, most of the time, sometimes when, especially when it was moving fast, but sometimes when it was moving slower, it kind of got away from this notion. But there was like an ongoing conversation. Mm-hmm. I felt almost to a certain degree like, like we're sitting in a big room with a bunch of people,
right.
and we're talking about different issues. You're calling on people, and so on and so right. forth. And that's what struck to me. It struck me as a way for the class to really have a conversation about what we're reading, a way for the class to communicate right. about what we're reading, and really focus on the topics that are important to us.
Right.
I've taken several classes in the past where it's hard to get into the class just because it's hard to find something that you're discussing in class, that you're writing papers on, that's important to you. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem interesting because it just doesn't seem that important.
Right.
But in a class like this, you're really able to pick out what's important to you as an individual, post it on the blog, and see other people's responses. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that doesn't have the backfire capability of just moving very fast right. sometimes.
Right.
But
I mean, one of the strategies I've tried to use to exert some influence on the direction, right? Is by in class highlighting specific posts mm-hmm. and knowing in my mind, okay, these are the issues I want to make sure we talk about. These are the things that are important. And it's really powerful for me as a faculty member to be able to draw on the multiplicity of voices that you've all put out there to say, okay, look, I'm going to highlight this post. It's really well written. It makes the point. It highlights the text I want to focus on. And that's really a powerful point. I want to get to Drew, unless this is, you guys have points right on this.
Well,
go ahead, Anne, Joni.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I am a person that sort of like my ideas get generated from like discussion right. and right. oh my gosh, discussion
exactly.
And bouncing ideas off of people. Mm-hmm. And I was going to say, I think a very effective way that we sort of, or at least that you have sort of directed the focus is through the class discussion and bringing up posts. And for me, at least personally, that helps me a lot. Like bringing up these topics, it generates more ideas that I want to continue the discussion on the blog past the class.
Yeah.
So
I hit on that sort of partway through the class, I think, maybe after the first quarter. I remember Jordan saying, you know, how are you pulling those exact posts and those comments among posts? Because it's so big. I figured out a way to do that, and I think that was important. And I can use it strategically as a faculty member to highlight people who might not speak in class mm-hmm. so readily and ask them, okay, well, this was a great post. What would you talk a little bit about it? So that's part of sort of a strategy I was trying to develop. Tony, I know you had a point about this, then we'll go to Drew.
One thing that's really cool to me, though, too, is that it might seem like it's just, you know, this just big conversation and then, you know, everything is kind of on an equal level, but it's interesting how we've kind of organically come to certain really salient issues. Like
right.
the fact that we had like 9 or 10 topics to talk about means that we were all interested in similar
right.
things.
Right.
And we just came about this kind of on our own in a lot of ways.
Well, it's the tagging. I mean, when we said at the beginning, okay, just tag things with a lot of different tags and let's watch how that tag cloud organically grows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
It's just, I just think that's cool because I was kind of thinking about it and, you know, sometimes, admittedly, I like to sort of have a knowledge base that I know I'm going to come out with, you know,
mm-hmm.
that I have some, you know, it's something to kind of, as a primer,
right.
to think about this dialogue or that dialogue. And it's interesting how we've almost created a sort of guide
right.
for ourselves
right.
and then talking about this.
And I do think that if you're just watching this blog online,
mm-hmm.
you're getting a different experience
yeah.
than we're getting together. Because I was actually struck by that because I have some friends on Twitter and things who are clearly reading the blog and talking to me about it. And it was clear to me at that point that there were certain things and dynamics that were happening in class that they just didn't get
yeah.
by just reading the blog. So it isn't just that online media. It is the community we've developed and how they that what's going on online goes into class and how what's happening in class goes online, so that we, you know, with the banter we have in class about, you know, pet concepts and pet things, that's part of what, you know, this allows. I go in and I know what people are basically thinking about, who they are a little bit. Jordan, I thought your post about, you know, why are we here at the one point, if you can remember back then, I don't know when that was, really elicited some real, powerful statements about why students are here. Now, Drew, do you remember what you were going to say?
I do. Not to completely shift gears, but like from another perspective, you know, coming on the blog, and like one thing that was kind of hard for me and still is to some degree, is that, you know, all of you guys pretty much post a lot, so I mean, like you have a lot to say, you have your pretty much your opinions fleshed out, and I know like Anthony, you know, does references to like Spinoza and all that. Like, I mean, you guys have.
We know that.
He does.
Yeah.
I know.
And Freud and stuff. But it seems like a lot of you who are either like philosophy majors or English majors, have a lot more background in previous thinkers that you can relate to this. Whereas, you know, coming on there, I have my own opinions, but my problem is I write really long posts. I'm aware of that. To some degree, it is kind of intimidating seeing, yeah, like, everybody having these really long discussions, you know, referencing things and, you know, different points from outside the class. You know,
and the challenge I have as a faculty member is, how do you allow turn that experience of intimidation into invitation, mm-hmm, so that it's pulling you to a higher level of understanding the material,
right,
rather than, oh gosh, I don't know this, and so I can't even begin to know how to speak.
Right. No, and it's not that I ever, like, I always felt welcome. Like, that's never been, right, an issue. Everybody's, right, always friendly. You know, they'll offer their opinion. If they they differ with you, they're not going to be, you know, too rough with you. They're just going to make their point, and then, you know, out of that, a good dialogue.
Except maybe Cody.
good comes out of that. So, I mean, right, it's not that there's anything necessarily wrong. It's just hard, you know, harder to, yeah, deal with for some.
Exactly. Cody, you want to say something?
Yeah, well, I totally feel for you, because I came into the class, I switched to this class kind of late, because I dropped the previous class that, mm-hmm, I was in. And I came in and I thought the first day, oh my God, what did I get myself into? Because people are dropping references for Socrates, and Spinoza comes into it. I'm like, Spinoza? I thought, right, that was, you know, I have no idea.
Is
that a person? I have no idea who this person even is.
Right.
But luckily, with the blog element that you've incorporated into the class, I was able to, I mean, my areas of interest is not philosophy.
Right.
It's politics, right, which is related, I know. But
sure.
And history. So I was able to, like, read the dialogue and say, hey, this relates to something that's interests me, and then I was able to connect it in a way that was able to I was able to participate in the class discussion without having that knowledge.
Right. And you really have played a great role in helping us cultivate a community around that. It's really important.
Yeah, I like digressions.
go ahead, Jordan. And then,
I think with any medium that we're going to use, it be it class discussion, lecture, blog, we're going to run into problems. But I think the fact that they've become so apparent, mm-hmm, is really helpful, because you can address them. The point of, right, a blog almost is that it's dynamic. You can change it. We've seen it throughout the class. Like, yeah, we take different stances on different stuff, and like slowly we kind of help cultivate people come in who don't feel as welcome. Like, some people, as you said, have a hard time finding their voice.
Right.
You know, and that's true for a class discussion too. But,
right,
I think it's easier on the blog, just because you're kind of removed while still being a very large part of it. And I think, right, Sam is a perfect example of this. Like, he didn't know really how to get involved with it,
right,
until a good way in. But, yeah, now, you know, he's really starting to get, yeah, his momentum going.
And sometimes it takes commenting. You know, I think I got to make sure that I emphasize the fact that you might not want to make a post, because we try to emphasize that a post is supposed to be a little bit more organized, a little bit more, mm-hmm, thought through, and commenting can be a little bit more colloquial. So sometimes it takes finding your voice as a commenter to come into that journey.
Well, kind of going off of what Drew was saying, just like the way that I sort of like formulate ideas, like I'm very much used to sort of starting small and then sort of bouncing off and sort of formulating bigger ideas. And so that was kind of an issue with me for the blog, because I'd have like these little seeds of ideas, but it was hard for me to get them cultivated without sort of like bouncing off. So that was sort of like the one thing that I like. That's why I like dialogue, because it's instantaneous. You know, you have constant feedback and constant back and forth. And with the blog, it was sort of like, you know, you put something out there and you'd have to wait and see if somebody would respond. And so it's sometimes hard to keep yourself on that track of thought.
Right.
If you're, you know, you go and do something else for a couple hours and then wait to see what else somebody says. But I think for the most part, everyone was pretty, for lack of a better word, very on top of it, I guess.
Yeah, people
you
were
know,
reading
constantly,
it. Was clear.
Yeah,
it
going.
Was clear. People were definitely engaged with it. Yeah, go ahead, Anthony.
And one of the really nice things, especially with comments, like I think throughout the semester I've only made 7 posts, and the comments make it really nice because you can go on there for 10 minutes, make a comment, and contribute.
Right.
I know personally I've had a very, very busy semester. I mean, coming up towards the end of it, I had 5 papers due at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I'm applying to grad schools. I'm writing my letters of intent, and I've just had a very hectic and very busy semester.
Right.
And having these comments and the ability to comment and comment a lot really allowed me to flourish on the blog where I might not otherwise have been able to with just posts.
Right.
And that's one of the nice things about not having this strict structure as to this many posts, this many comments.
Right. Yeah, I keep resisting that. But when I talk to other faculty about, oh, well, you mean you don't have any, well, you're not counting, you know, this is a minimum number of posts. How do you do that? I say, well, the rubric drives it. But I'm wondering what happens as a student when you have, obviously you have to manage your time, certain times of the semester, midterm, those things, everybody's assigning papers, right? So it makes sense to me that at those times the blog might slow down, right? It has a rhythm. It increases when I have a period of evaluation and people get that in. Okay, that's okay. I would like to have people cultivating the habit of critically reflecting in writing in public on all of the reading that they're doing and in fact on their life experiences, as Jordan, you did when you were commenting, when you were a post about, you know, being late on a train being late, right? So that was great. But I wonder what happens when you have a busy schedule. Does it push my course as a faculty back to the back burner, or does it give you flexibility to sort of manage that yourself?
I felt that it gave me a lot of flexibility. I know there were specific times where I died on the blog for like a week and a half.
Yeah, you went quiet there for a while.
Yeah, just because like at one point I had a big Freud paper coming up, and I ended up having to write that.
Right. Yeah,
twice.
Then we got a lot of Freud references. Okay.
Yeah.
But that's actually a powerful way in which the classes blend into each other. Because Pam, I know your class on rhetoric clearly related to mine. That having that content on the blog really helped us, and actually have that inspired my desire to go talk to Chris Johnson and have a digital dialogue with him. And so that's sort of a grassroots way of getting faculty to talk to each other if we can be responsive to, oh wow, Pam said that Chris Johnson's talking about this in his class. Let me go talk to him a little bit more about it. And that's a pretty powerful thing to have happen. So Jordan, did you want to say something?
I think I have another class where there's you have to have a minimum of posts. It's 7 posts online on Angel.
Right.
And people post 7 times.
Right.
They're not really that substantive. They're enough to get they're enough to get it out of the way. You know, at that point it becomes I don't know, it's just something to do.
Yeah.
Here it's your requirement is be active.
Right.
Be thoughtful.
That's right.
And I think that gets across in your syllabus, and I think that gets across in the class. And by other people being active beyond what is needed, people feel that they can just do it, you know?
Well, this is an example today, this our discussion, Cody's suggestion that maybe we need a semester roundup podcast, and then my embracing that as an episode of the digital dialogue. It is a community that is possible only when you have people willing to engage in it. And I just want to thank you all and everyone who's been in this class for showing me the possibilities of this mode of teaching. It's a work in progress. I'm always trying to get better at thinking about the possibilities it opens and the problems it also potentially causes. But your voices and the collective document that we've created this semester and the living document that we have created is really a testament to your work and to our work together. So thank you all very much.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to the Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of the Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for the Digital Dialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue.